Hi, I'm John Curran, and I'm interested in the ways that everyday culture shapes who we are and how things work, like organizations, team dynamics, or consumer behavior. Welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast, where I try and understand the ways in which we can learn to unwrap the often unpredictable, unconscious, and complex nature of culture. In this episode, I'm going to explore the concept of culture and conflict. It feels that we're navigating many forms of conflict in the world at the moment, from war to how we think about work and its future, to how we live our lives on a daily basis. This episode looks at how conflict exists within organizations and team dynamics. However, much of what I will talk about with my guest will also have relevance to all areas of conflict. From my anthropological background and as an organizational consultant, I frame conflict as a part of culture and not something that sits outside culture and threatens it. Instead of running away from conflict, one can reframe it as a form of communication. It is trying to tell us something that maybe we do not want to hear because it might hold uncomfortable truths or taboos we don't want to face up to. In this episode, I speak to Alex Efthymiadis, who is an expert on workplace conflict and mediation. She is the co-founder of Consensio Partners and works with organizations offering training and mediation. A few years ago, I had the privilege of training under Alex, and it empowered me to be able to situate conflict at the core of much of what I do as an organizational consultant and as a team coach and executive coach. Alex brings to the conversation many important, interesting insights. One thing she said was that every human relationship has conflict and that it is not a bad thing, but a necessary thing. She defines conflict as a breakdown of relationships that can be something quite small, but that could become something quite big. Too often, we see leaders shy away from addressing workplace conflict at an early stage, and Alex and I talk about why this is the case. What's really good about this episode is that Alex also explains the three main myths around workplace conflict. If you're interested in organizational culture, leadership, coaching, human resources, the social sciences, psychodynamic approaches to organizational consultancy, then this episode will give you a deep understanding to why conflict exists in the workplace and how it can be addressed. So let's get into the conversation with Alex. Alex, welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast.
Hi, John. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to be here as well. I often kind of start this each podcast kind of trying to locate where I am. And the previous podcast I did, I was actually able to do it face-to-face. But I'm back in my home studio in Crystal Palace in South London, which is actually lovely and sunny today. I'm just wondering, where are you present today?
I am also at home, so in my home office, and it is a beautiful day and the sun is streaming in, and yeah, it makes us all happy, doesn't it, to have some sunshine.
It's the early feeling of spring, which is just delightful. But we're going to be talking about conflict, and we're going to be talking about conflict in the workplace and in organizations. And you know, Alex, I've known you for a while, I've trained under you, and we're going to kind of be going deep into what is conflict resolution, mediation. But I kind of want to first start with a bit about you, really. What was your road, your kind of avenue, your journey into conflict resolution in this area?
Yeah. So I moved to New York City when I was 18 to go to university. And when I was living in New York, I became really interested in issues of social justice. There's obviously, this was back in the 90s, lots of inequality, lots of ways in which one could make a difference. So I worked in soup kitchens, I tutored a little girl in an inner city school. And I also worked with street prostitutes. It was an organization who was handing out condoms and doing HIV testing for street workers. And so I became really interested in this. And when I did my master's degree at Columbia University in organizational psychology, there was an opportunity as part of the degree to become a community mediator in the South Bronx. And that tied in really nicely into my interest in conflict resolution, but also issues around social justice. So I became a community mediator in the South Bronx. I did some mediation cases there, and I just was fascinated by it. I thought, wow, this is amazing. You know, you can, I could suddenly apply the skills I was learning at university, so theory-based, with a practice of mediation in a kind of social justice context. So I really enjoyed that. And later, I left New York. I worked in Honduras at a women's rights organization. And I started applying some of my conflict resolution skills there. There were lots of conflicts going on in the organization. And I did some training, some workshops, and they seemed to work well. Many years later, I did another degree, another master's degree in development studies. And I worked at the UN in Geneva doing some research for a year. But then I wanted to come back to London, and I actually ended up getting a job at a mediation organization. And later in 2007, so quite a long time ago now, about 15 years ago, I set up Consensio with Anna Shields, my business partner, because we wanted to set up an organization that looked at workplace conflict, offered mediation and conflict resolution services, but also looked at, we were also interested in how can we prevent destructive conflict? And that there seemed to be a gap there in London. And I think we've tried to fill that gap. And so that's where I am now as co-founder and co-director of Consensio. You're working with lots of different organizations, trying to help them understand conflict better, prevent conflict, and resolve it.
That's great. I was kind of thinking about when you were saying that, are there kind of links or similarities between what the themes around conflict and mediation that you were experiencing in the South Bronx?
Yeah.
Kind of clients now, because I think with Consensio, yeah, you work across industry, so it isn't just one set. I mean, I'm throwing that as a kind of swerveball question, but were there similarities or universal?
Yeah. And you know, it's such an interesting question, John, because absolutely. And I think it kind of doesn't matter where you are, you know, whether you're in the South Bronx working in the community or in Honduras working with women who are, you know, involved in women's rights, or in an organization in London, be it a bank or an NGO or any public sector organization. We're all human, and we actually experience conflict in quite similar ways. Yes, one could argue there are certain cultural differences, but conflict brings up certain emotions in us that I think are universal. And so actually, it's been very easy to apply what I've learned in those different places to any kind of organization, because as human beings, we are very emotional, and we also all experience conflict.
When we're thinking about conflict, then kind of stepping back, you know, we both work as kind of outsiders coming into organizations, right?
Yeah.
But when we think about organizational conflict, how would you frame that?
So I guess I would frame it by saying conflict is any type of breakdown of say a relationship, but it doesn't have to be a serious breakdown. It can be just a temporary breakdown or a temporary misunderstanding. It can be something quite small that quickly grows into something quite big. So I don't see conflict as this kind of bombastic, explosive thing that needs to happen. It can start just with, by a very small disagreement or an email sent in haste that wasn't written sensitively. And so how we then respond to that kind of dictates the way that the conflict will go. And so sometimes people will say, well, we don't have any conflict in our organization, but that's impossible. Every human relationship has conflict. And that's not a bad thing. That's a necessary thing.
That's really interesting. I think from my background as the kind of interested in organizational culture and the kind of social sciences, so anthropology, for example, the idea of conflict being part of culture.
Yeah.
So it's not on the outside. It's almost like a vessel of communication trying to tell you something that you have to work with rather than get rid of.
That's right. That's right. You have to work with conflict. You shouldn't avoided, and neither should you be scared of it, actually, because if there is a conflict, it means that there's something that needs to be addressed. And that has to be the starting point, because if you see it simply as, okay, so here's a conflict, a big one or a small one, it doesn't matter, it means we have to address it, then you realize that an avoidance tactic, which is what a lot of organizations employ, or dealing with it overly aggressive, aren't helpful. The first step is, let's examine what is going on before we try to resolve anything, because there may not be anything that needs to be resolved.
I think that's a really good point. I kind of sometimes bang my head against the wall when I'm reading about how articles in business magazines or journals frame what organizational culture is. And it sometimes feels too simplistic. And
yeah.
I think one of my previous podcasts was with Professor Jennifer Howard-Grenville from Cambridge Judge Business School. And she wrote this fantastic thing about the myths of organizational culture.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, are there also myths relating to how organizations view what conflict is?
Absolutely. And I think so. There are many, 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 but I'll tell you kind of the top three as I see them in my work. The first myth is that conflict is bad. So conflict is bad. Let's get rid of it. Let's, try to kind of, I guess, work against it. So that's the first myth. The second myth is, when there is a conflict, there's always someone to blame. Brené Brown, Dr. Brené Brown at the University of Houston, has done some really interesting work on this, because actually it's not about blaming at all. And she says something like, blaming is a discharge of anger and hurt. And that's how I see it as well. So conflict doesn't mean that it's anybody's fault. And again, if we, and a lot of organizations do, and if you look at their grievance and disciplinary processes, it's often about blame. There's a victim, there's a perpetrator. Yeah, let's investigate and then find evidence and then decide one way or the other. So that's the other myth. And then the third myth is that it's a problem that needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So I think those are three. And I think partly those myths exist because of our fear and avoidance of conflict, but partly they also exist because we don't have enough self-awareness of how we are in conflict and that we actually have a responsibility in how we are contributing to the conflict dynamic. Instead, we blame someone else, we push it onto someone else, we don't look at our own behaviors.
I think I remember that point around blame, and especially under the training many years ago I did under you, but the idea of once you get to that stage of blame, you want to rally the troops.
That's right.
And the other person wants to rally their troops. So all of a sudden you've got the kind of two silos taking place.
Yeah.
In your experience, so how do leaders and managers usually approach conflict? How do they work with conflict?
So I would say they don't work sufficiently with conflict. So I think there is a lot of avoidance. Part of that avoidance is because I think that a lot of leaders feel that if they admit there is a conflict, then in some way they have failed.
Okay.
And actually, I don't see conflict as a leadership failure at all. So I think that's the first step. Leaders need to understand that conflict will happen. It's supposed to happen. There are some really good things about conflict, and we can get to that later, John, because I know it's just a very interesting and researched area as well. But so it's not a leadership failure. I think as well, organizations aren't doing enough to upskill leaders to deal with conflict. So, you know, if you look at a leadership development program, it might have something around time management or performance management or work-life balance. That's all important. But what about the courses on courageous conversations or conflict resolution skills or mediation skills? So it's as if managers are being promoted because of their technical skills, but not their people skills. And if you're promoting them because of their people skills, you need to make sure they have conflict resolution skills as well.
That's a really important. I think that there definitely is a growing trend around leaders as coaches are better leaders. And of course, some of the coaching skills you learn are very helpful around kind of working with conflict, but it still doesn't address the term conflict.
Yeah.
You know, which is a quite an interesting kind of sign there about this denial of wanting to bring it to the forefront or something. I think it was Margaret Heffernan, a business professor at Bath University, in one of her TED Talks, talked about 75% of executives who were surveyed in the US and Europe don't want to speak about things they feel that they need to because of a fear of conflict. Yeah. So which kind of then begs the question, is conflict already existing? If they fear conflict, but they can't speak freely, is there conflict already? You know,
absolutely. And I think it goes back as well to, you know, if you look at schools, they're not teaching children conflict resolution skills. If you look at how we're brought up, very often we don't speak about conflict in families. We don't see conflict being played out in a healthy and constructive way. So we're already growing up in a society in which conflict is viewed negatively and in which we're not supposed to be talking about conflict.
So how can organizations embrace conflict? So, if conflict is something that exists, it's not just on the periphery, it raises its ugly head. It is part of how we work and live our lives. How does an organization go about embracing conflict?
Yeah, I think it's really important for organizations, so be that OD departments or HR, et cetera, to look at some of the research in this area. So Dr. Peter Coleman, professor of psychology at Columbia University, for example, who was one of my professors when I was there doing my master's degree, he writes extensively about conflict. And so, to give you an example, he writes about research on conflict in high functioning teams. And so what he says is that we actually need conflict. And so, because what is conflict really? Let's deconstruct it and look at some of the kind of elements of conflict. And it's about differences of opinion, different ideas. It's about cultures clashing, he says. It's about this energy that comes when we bring differences to the table. And so if we're not allowing that to happen, we're missing out on a huge opportunity for creativity, innovation, but also we're missing out on an opportunity to strengthen relationships at work, to have more honest and open conversations at work that are good for our well-being, but are also good for our levels of engagement, team morale, loyalty, etc. So he says, for example, if there's a team and there's too much cooperation, and obviously cooperation is a good thing, but if there's only cooperation without conflict, that can lead to groupthink and inertia.
I see. So in a way, conflict can work as a, so number one, conflict can be a force of creativity, but it's there as a means of facilitating almost collaboration. So there isn't groupthink. It's there to prevent group. So, okay. So, but it, so that, if that research was packaged up and I'm head of HR, or I look at that and go, well, that's a no brainer.
Yeah.
We need to be working with this, but we don't. We don't embrace it. Now, you've mentioned previously about there's a fear of being perceived as a failure. My team's failing if there's conflict. Yeah. What other barriers are in place that prevent that type of mindset to see conflict as a potential tool to leading to creativity? What are the barriers that prevent that?
You know, John, I think there's maybe a broader issue as well, in that we're not taking relationships at work seriously enough. You know, I think that people have huge pressures at work, that some relationships have become very transactional. I think that people often don't feel respected at work. They don't feel they can trust their organization or their managers, etc. And so they're working in an environment which isn't conducive to really building these high-functioning teams and high-performing teams, because maybe organizations are focusing on the wrong things. You know, they're focusing on KPIs, or they're focusing on the bottom line, and they're maybe ignoring some of what really makes teams function well and what makes people feel really happy about where they work.
We've kind of spoken about how conflict can be a positive force. What are there different types of conflict that we can experience? Are there kind of personas of conflict within the workplace?
Yes, I think so. And so I'll talk a little bit about my work. So, kind of the mediations that we do, conflict coaching, conflict resolution training, etc. I think there's a lot around misunderstanding. And part of that has to do with technology. So I think people over-relying on email contact, for example. So definitely, you know, it's so easy to misread things, to infer people's tone in an email that may not be there. So I think this over-reliance on technology, which again takes us away from the human relationships. I think that people's workloads often means that they're not taking time to just walk over to somebody's desk and have a conversation with them, or ask someone to go out for a coffee just so you can, you know, clear the air or talk about something that might be bothering you. So I think I think technology is a huge contributor to conflict. So what we see in our work, often it's misunderstandings. It's also conflicts around roles and responsibilities not being clear. That leads to conflict. And then also things like people not feeling valued leads to conflict, people not feeling trusted or respected at work, and people not feeling like they're doing something meaningful to them. And so this in some way has to be addressed as well.
That's a really interesting point about the value, feeling value, because if you stand back and think about, well, what does that mean? I want a pay rise, or actually, it's not. Yeah. I think a lot of employee engagement surveys identify that, but actually, what they want, or a lot of employees want, is just for their manager or leads to go, you know, that was a great bit of work.
Absolutely.
That simplicity of acknowledgement, rather than, you know, I want more money.
Yes.
Yeah. Being able to kind of, and it's amazing how impactful that is on individuals.
Yeah. But yeah.
Do we have different kind of forms of conflict between, let's say, individuals within a team? So you talked about roles and responsibilities and being valued, but what about conflict between teams? Does that play out at all?
It does. And so I guess sometimes what we see, so we do both two-party mediation, so where it's two individuals whose relationship has broken down in some way, or also team mediation. So, for example, where the relationship between teams, either within or between teams, has broken down. What we sometimes find is that when a client calls us and says, can you come in and do a team mediation for us, it is because that organization has waited too long to address a conflict that was quite small, potentially between two people, and that has been allowed to escalate in an unaddressed way to then kind of contaminate the whole team. However, so I'm thinking of one case we're doing at the moment where part of the conflict, and it's two teams that are supposed to be working together in a healthcare setting but aren't. Part of the issue is also that one of the teams feels that the other team is taking over some of their work.
Okay.
And, you know, that might be attributable to roles and responsibilities not being clear, but also the team that feels that team A is kind of taking over the work of team B also feels that they're not being valued, that they're not being trusted, that that is why team A is able to take over what they're supposed to be doing. So a lot of it comes back to people's perceptions of how they're being treated.
Mm.
And issues around fairness and justice and all of that obviously then impacts their ability to do their job well and their work satisfaction as well.
I'm kind of, you know, working as an organizational anthropologist, interested in how rituals are played out as well. So yeah. One of the rituals I've identified are what I call rituals of resistance. So that's when a sense of authority or identity or role is challenged. So we form behaviors, boundaries as a team and also as an individual as a means of countering that threat. And I'm just trying to think about when you're looking at those team A, team B, do you notice certain types of narratives, behaviors, patterns, routines, rituals that seem to manifest themselves as normal, as rational?
Yes. So one of the things I notice over and over in the work that we do is this victim mentality that we start to embrace. So where people start seeing each other as victim and the other team, for example, as the perpetrator. And so they become very unified because they see, I guess they feel bullied and they feel that they as a unit are stronger than if they were individuals. So there's that strange thing that happens as well in conflict where suddenly a team is strengthened because they are in conflict with another team. And that gives them a sense of purpose and identity and meaning that they didn't have before. And then it actually can become quite difficult to want to resolve the conflict because the conflict is actually bringing you closer together with certain people. And that can be something positive. So definitely that. And then I think, and then actually also just this, I guess one could say paranoia a little bit, that you don't trust another team and you then no longer trust the organization. It becomes something quite broad where that distrust translates into something much bigger and more damaging potentially.
thinking about where we are now and what you've been describing, it kind of feels like, you know, these are some of the innate cause of what it is to be human and also a social animal, right? So yeah. Both individual, but also part of group. And I'm just thinking, well, surely this is just, presents itself with the experience that we've had, we as society, for the last 2 years around lockdown, around then the emergence of hybrid working, what is it, Zoom, Teams. Is that the case, or have you also noticed that there have been different types or strands of conflict that have emerged?
I would say that probably since early 2020, we've all been living in this kind of fight or flight mode to a certain degree. You know, there's kind of always this low level adrenaline and cortisol pumping through our bodies. And so that uncertainty we've been living with causes anxiety. And so what we're seeing is there's more demand for mediation than there ever has been. And I think partly that's due to the pandemic. And I also think that I was speaking with one of my work colleagues who does a lot of mediations with Consensio. And she was saying that every single mediation she's done, and there have been hundreds, obviously, someone has been impacted by COVID in some way. Be that because they have lost a loved one, be that because they have been worried about their own health or the health of a loved one, be that because they don't agree with the organization's policies around risk and health and safety around COVID, et cetera. It's had a huge impact. And I don't think we've seen the end of it. I think, you know, even if hopefully this pandemic ends soon, I think that the trauma we have all, just to greater or lesser degrees, had to live through will stay with us for a while. And that will in some way contaminate workplaces and how we are with each other at work. What's also been interesting is we've done some mediation cases where the conflict was around one person feeling that somebody else wasn't taking COVID seriously enough, or where, you know, perhaps they weren't wearing a mask in a communal area. And so they felt that that person was threatening their safety and well-being.
Okay, that's really interesting. Also, before lockdown, or before COVID came on the scene, and then early stages of lockdown, there were two other big kind of impacts or movements, social movements, one of which was Me Too.
That's right.
And the other one was Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And if we think about how they, over a period of 18 months, 2 years, have manifested themselves and been present within organizations, so pay gap, sexism, misogynistic kind of normalization of behavior in the workplace, and then racism. How, or do you experience that you are also having to work with those type of kind of structural, I guess it's structural conflicts, is that the right term? I don't know. But, you know, kind of the socio-political aspects of society that also come into the workplace.
Yeah. Absolutely. So definitely Me Too and Black Lives Matter has made a huge difference in terms of people and obviously very, very usefully feeling that they now have a voice and a vocabulary with which to speak about systemic structural discrimination and suddenly having the courage to address this in the workplace and to speak out about it. However, that has not always landed well with people who were quite happy with the status quo. And so we have also noticed absolutely that there have been more cases where a client has called us and said there's a case of where someone feels discriminated against due to gender, sexuality, race, religion, etc. Can you come in and mediate? Right. Mediation isn't always the right tool to address those issues. However, it has been really heartening to see that come up, because I think these are conversations we need to have as a society. and that are obviously still being repressed.
And then kind of homing in a little bit about the actual work you do or the process at Consensio. You talk about facilitating conflict, and I'm kind of thinking about mediation. What does that actually look like? And I mean, I'm kind of talking kind of vaguely here. I've done your training, but the process, what does that entail?
Yeah. So basically, what we believe is that the best way to resolve a conflict, or to not even to resolve a conflict, the best way to talk conflict is by actually talking about it. So, and you know, not every mediation results in resolution. So what we do is we meet with people first individually to try to understand from them what's going on from your perspective, because obviously we each view a conflict situation very differently. So what I see as bullying, you might see as performance management, etc. And so we're trying to hear the story of the person who is experiencing some kind of workplace conflict. And then we bring them in a room together with an impartial mediator or facilitator to try to facilitate a conversation between the two individuals in an empathic way, in a way in which people feel heard, they feel able to talk about their feelings, their emotions, the hurt that the conflict has caused them. Because I think what people forget is that conflict always causes hurt if it isn't in some way dealt with or spoken about. And so we need to address that hurt. And a lot of leaders, a lot of HR professionals don't really feel confident talking about those feelings. And it's quite interesting. There's some great research from Mark Brackett at the Yale University Center of Emotional Intelligence. And he speaks about how we need to be curious explorers of our own and others' emotions. And I think there's so much separation still between work and personal life, where we often think, I'm not allowed to bring my emotional self into the workplace, but we're all emotional beings. And so mediation and the work that we do allows us to be emotional beings with each other and to talk about why was your behavior difficult for me? You know, this is how it made me feel. And let's talk about how we can have a different type of working relationship where we don't feel that we're being disrespected or mistrusted or undervalued, etc.
But I'm kind of imagining if you have two people that need mediation, they agree to it, they come into a room, they sit at a table, and there's a mediator. Do you find in your experience that they're presenting themselves ready to come to some form of an agreement, or are they still in the kind of battlefields of I'm right, you're wrong?
Yeah, both. So sometimes they're ready, sometimes they understand, sometimes they want to come to some kind of agreement or resolution or just a better way of working together, but sometimes they don't. And I think often it depends on how long has this conflict been allowed to go on without that conversation ever taking place. And obviously, the longer you leave it, the more entrenched people become, the more intractable the conflict becomes. So ideally, you wouldn't even need mediation because people would have the confidence and the skills to have these conversations as soon as there's an issue that's bothering them. Right. And part of that, of course, goes back to psychological safety. So this is a term coined by Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson. Do people feel safe enough to come up with, you know, ideas, issues, problems without feeling that they're going to be punished because of it? So is controversy allowed? Are new ideas allowed? And I don't think a lot of people believe or feel that they work in psychologically safe environments.
That's a really interesting point. It made me kind of think about you know, what you said, that, you know, ideally that there isn't the need for mediation, but I guess we could flip it and actually say, well, maybe mediation should be present all the time in relation to if conflict is a tension that can be creative and controversial, and you can challenge.
Yes.
It's got an energy to it that could potentially easily tip over. And there's something there about how do you bring that back? And maybe mediation, a bit like coaching.
Yeah.
Is there as a necessity to have those kind of conversations?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is about conversation, is it?
It is. It's about conversation. I wish that people would be able to have those conversations, though, without having to call in Consensio. So that, or because it's so empowering to have these conversations, but at the moment, people don't feel empowered to have them. So what they have instead of these is these really disempowering processes around disciplinary or grievances, when actually, I wish that workplaces could, and again, going back to embrace conflict and say, you know what, let's talk about this. Let's create a high-functioning team in which we're able to have these difficult conversations. And I think, you know, Brené Brown says we have to kind of lean into the discomfort. These are not easy conversations, but they're necessary.
This is kind of, it's my mind's now going with kind of scenarios, but scenarios I've experienced when coaching teams, and there's sometimes I call it the fairy cake moment, which is, and I'll tell you what I mean by this. It's when the leader, the team leader, let's say, there'll be an important meeting, but we know that in that meeting there's some real challenges. But the team leader might bring fairy cakes as a kind of, hey, let's have some, as a kind of smokescreen of like, I'm your friend, I'm your parent.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm not wrong, am I?
Yeah.
But the whole team feel collectively that they're not having a leader who's leading.
Yes.
So there's a tension, there's a conflict, and there kind of acts and performances being played.
Yeah.
So there's a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But it's being played out. It's happening in the corridors and discussions, and what I've noticed in the past, that leader doesn't usually last for long.
No, that's right. That's right.
And you could argue that the outcome was positive,
yeah,
but
yeah,
something, a performance was allowed to play out. There was no real, you know, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, and that's the beauty about conflict conversations, be they one-to-one with a coach, with a mediator, with a facilitator, it doesn't matter. What it does is, if you have a conversation about a conflict, big or small, it doesn't matter. It means that there's movement. There's clarity. And the movement may not be in the direction that you had envisaged, i.e., it might mean that someone decides they want to leave the team, but at least there's movement. Because in a sense, if there's conflict and it's not being addressed, you're kind of stuck. And so you need the energy to come out. And that energy comes out often by having a conversation.
Yeah. What about gossip? I mean, I know this is good. I mean, I remember when I did my PhD, I spent a few weeks studying in the Wellcome Institute around kind of the history of 18th century psychiatric hospitals. They weren't called that at the time, but the doctor was called the superintendent, and they used to write all the manuals for nurses, who were all, of course, women. And I was really amazed to see a whole lot written about the danger of gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And that gossip was only something that nurses did, because that's what women did. Therefore, and they talked about it being kept in the closet. Don't bring it out.
Yeah.
But you could also argue, I mean, if you look at political governments, there's the leaking to the media or the leaking, you know, and that's a kind of gossip thing. Yeah. Is there a role that gossip plays that actually, of course, we see it as negative, but actually, is there a role that it can get things moving?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, by repressing gossip, you're repressing the problem, right? If the gossip is happening because there's a problem, then you don't want to repress that. Then actually what you want is, as a leader, to say, look, I know there's gossip going on. Can we talk about this? You know, let's bring it out. Let's gossip together and try to find a solution, or just talk about it. And I think that's the thing. So much of what we're trying to do is repress what's negative or what's perceived as negative. And I think gossip, actually, it's also a way of people bonding, isn't it? Yeah. So again, people, and there's some great research about this in terms of the importance of bonding for high functioning teams and people kind of people's enjoyment of work. You need to focus on relationships. And for some people, that focus on relationship means a bit of gossip.
Mm. Yeah. Gossip Fridays.
Yes.
the great British gossip or whatever. Yeah. The final kind of question here is, so if I'm head of HR coming to you and go, look, just give me some advice. What do I need to start putting in place in my organization?
Yeah.
To be able to embrace conflict, but work with it.
Yeah.
What advice would you be giving?
I would say, are your leaders modeling the behaviors that they expect other people to engage in? I think very often, you know, there's this real blind spot. We want to have a really great high-functioning organization. Are we modeling the behaviors that are necessary for that? I think as well, we need to listen more and talk less, because I think that very often when people come to us, it's because they need a sounding board or they need their feelings validated, and not because they want us to solve their problems. And I also think that organizations need to seriously think about what are the skills of great leaders, of high functioning teams, and are we doing what we can in terms of upskilling people and giving them the confidence to actually be the leaders that we want them to be? And I think there's such a gap often, you know, when I talk to clients, they're not looking at the research. They're not looking at what is actually going to make a difference to our organization. There's great research out there. It's easy to find, but definitely we need to upskill people to be better able to deal with conflict and to embrace conflict as well. And I think organizations need to see this as this is normal. This is what human interactions are about. There will be conflict, and that can be such a good thing.
Does. So I end all my podcasts with symbolically presenting or handing over to you, which I'm doing through Zoom, the Anthropologist's notebook. And you can take this notebook to any organization or anywhere in the world, and you can go and do an anthropological study for 1 year. Where will you be taking this notebook and why?
So I would be taking this notebook into family settings rather than an organization. The reason being, because I think we need to start looking at the ways in which we are teaching our children from a very young age about conflict and human interactions, so that hopefully their generation will be able to make better use of the energy and creativity and innovation of conflict, and less repressive about some of the issues that are bringing so many people a lot of unhappiness at work. So I would be looking at families.
Well, I think that's brilliant. Families are the original organization, right?
And yeah, that's
so,
right.
So much has come out of that. I'm thinking attachment theory and Bowlby, yes, and how that works within organizations and yeah, other ways there. And the complexity and mess is quite the creative space. Yeah. Alex, thank you so much for being on the Decoding Culture podcast.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you found my conversation with Alex insightful and you have a deeper understanding to the role conflict plays in organizations, in teams, and between individuals. There are lots of interesting articles on the Consensio site that you can download, and the link also to the website will be in the show notes. And please do subscribe to the podcast feed, and please give the podcast a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business, and anthropology, sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter, and the link will also be in the show notes. See you next time.
Thank you.